Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Dear Asian Girl, a podcast for Asian girls by Asian girls. On today's episode, we have Chaya Kavali, who is a PhD and currently a senior program officer in entrepreneurship at the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation. Chaya, could you introduce yourself with your name and your pronouns?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Isabella. My name's Chaya, and my pronouns are she, her. And like you said, I'm a program officer, which just means I'm a grant maker at a foundation in Kansas City, Missouri. So I was born in India. I'm half Indian, and my mom's family is from Kansas, so half Indian, half white. And I moved to the States when I was about 12.
And my name is Isabel Leong. My pronouns are they, she. I'm a Vietnamese Burmese first generation daughter. And Nana, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure, I'm Nana. I'm also a podcast co-host. Of course, that's why you're listening to my voice. I am Indian. My parents are from Punjab. I am based in Singapore, but from Los Angeles originally. I've lived there for most of my life. And yeah, I'm very excited to have this conversation with you today. So your research, as well as other academics, have found the drawbacks of white-led local food movements. And when we hear the word local, often there's a very positive connotation to that because local farmers support your local businesses, et cetera, et cetera. It's very easy to say, and it's always the quick recommendation for people who want to become more sustainable in their daily lifestyles. And I previously wasn't knowledgeable about this topic before I was researching it. And beforehand, the words local food movement would have been relatively positive to me. So for our listeners who are similarly inexperienced with this research, could you share firstly the general intention behind the local food movement and how it initiated in the United States, like the history of that, and where it sort of went wrong?
Yeah, so it's like come in cycles, right? So like the history that I'm familiar with, probably somebody who's in their 50s would be like, what are you talking about? Like this was a thing in the 70s, you know? And so like, I know in the 70s, there was like the back to the land movement and like folks were just like, you know, William Thoreau-ing it and just like getting out in the woods and like just done with it. And so I think like people go through cycles of that. But what I became aware of is like, and I've written about this before, you know, when I moved to the States, I was like trying to think through how do I, you know, I really want to farm and like make my food locally and like connect with my family in that way. And so I was joining up into like the local food movement at that time, because starting in, I think like early 2000s, it was becoming a thing again, right? Like Michael Pollan wrote this book, Omnivore's Dilemma, and people just went crazy for it. He was like talking about, you know, the harms in industrial agriculture and to harms to our bodies. So like one famous thing he wrote about was how much corn, like corn syrup, is in so much stuff in the US. And so like if you slice open a human body from the US, you'd be like, ah, it's all corn. He's like, that cannot be good. And so like talking about loss of genetic diversity. And so that's what people were thinking about, right? Like, oh no, this is depleting our soils. Our bodies are probably unhealthier. Our animals are sick. And so local food movement was like, let's grow food locally. Let's grow food in regenerative ways. Let's think about like what we're putting in the earth and in our bodies, which are all like great things. Totally agree with that. That movement became pretty exclusionary though, because at least the white-led popular movement, and that's what I started writing about. Because when I joined into those groups, people were like, you know, really like fetishizing Eastern stuff and were like, oh my gosh, you know, I just learned about turmeric, I'm putting it in everything. Or like, you know, just like really taking all these Eastern traditions and like folks at BIPOC things have been leading on, and then like acting like it was something they had just discovered. And so that felt really exclusionary. And that has continued to be pretty popular, I think. Even though now I think hopefully more folks are learning about like food sovereignty and food justice, which are the same kind of idea about taking care with our food system, but also taking care with BIPOC communities alongside that.
And how would you say like policy and political implications changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to speak ill will of First Lady Michelle Obama. I love her, but one thing she did was, talk about like she had the White House garden and put in all of these movements about like get your kids moving, our kids are too fat, like really hurtful things that I think again like individualize all these problems that are happening in our communities and like ignoring that they're structural problems. And so it sort of became like insidious in politics at that time. Like, oh, like things are going wrong in that community. Just like start a community garden. Don't worry about housing crisis. Don't like worry about crime. Just like grow your food.
And where do you see that like pervade today? Obviously, I think for me at least, I still see like the whole garden idea, especially in a lot of public schools now. A lot of schools in my area have gardens and very This is the school systems and the people in it really love the idea of having a garden and like pretending like the food from the garden is like being f like served in the dining halls and the cafeterias, but that's definitely not the case. And then also recently, before COVID, Jill Shaw, I think she like owns Wayfair or something. Her and her husband had a movement in Boston where they tried to change. Or they tried to implement more healthier foods into the city's public school system, but it backfired because there was no cultural or there was no intersectionality of what they were thinking about what to serve and what they thought was healthy versus what kids actually wanted to eat. And that ended up with kids just not wanting to eat the food that these people were funding. And that's clearly like a problem that, these people who do have money and want to give back, and it's kind of giving the idea of people who have a lot of money and who want to help, but they're just really misinformed about what communities actually need. And they kind of just walk in and act like their money and their signing checks will solve the problem without genuinely having conversations with community members, teachers, students, families. And et cetera. So specifically in Kansas, what is the local food movement trying to achieve? And how is the whiteness of the movement problematic?
Yeah, so first I want to say I really appreciate that point you just made. Like, I know I've heard before people be like, in my community, I live in a predominantly Black, low-income neighborhood, and folks are always talking about like access to Wi-Fi and like digital equity things. But if you're like a funder, that's probably a less sexy thing. They're like, oh no, I want photos of somebody in their community garden. Like, and so I think that really shapes the things that people care about, and that's really sad and problematic.
Oh yeah, this woman made a whole documentary about this.
Of
So
course she
she
did.
was trying to get I, it was a lot about her image as well as trying to help. So
Well, I'm gonna hate watch that. Thank you for
yeah.
that. So in Kansas City in particular, my research, like I said, I was an ethnography of white folks in the movement. So I was looking at like how are white urban farmers talking about their work? How are like folks who run nonprofits focused on helping support local agriculture talking about their work? And then how are food aid folks talking about it? And I think what's problematic is like just really, again, like a lack of intersectionality. One of the main things I found is that like urban agriculture greatly contributes to gentrification. And so like real estate folks will market a house, just they'll knock it up $20,000 just if there's like an urban farm nearby and it's in the listing. And like an urban farmer can't necessarily like stop that, but they should be aware of the fact that like if you move into a spot, this is going to happen. How can you protect your neighbors? And so like that wasn't being talked about, the disproportionate impacts on communities of color. And then this idea of like we talked about like healthy bodies and like really based on white bodies and white health, that was not taking into account systemic problems. And that was not taking into account that, like, particularly in Kansas City, folks of color have been like farming in urban space for a long, long time. And so you see, like, historically, even as like redlining comes through and waves of gentrification and waves of violence in every community that like Black and Latinx folks were landing in, they were growing their food. They had urban farms. They weren't like these sexy urban farms that folks are like talking about now, but they were, providing for themselves and eating in really healthy ways. And then we have this programming led by this movement that's ignoring all of that and saying these people don't know how to feed themselves. And it's like, no, they've been pushed around the city through acts of violence, and you're not acknowledging it. And so that I think is like primarily where the exclusionary whiteness comes in.
Yeah, and a bit more in the context of Kansas, I know that there's quite a stark segregation between the or Kansas City. Could you share a bit more about the split between that and how that connects to what you were saying about how urban farmers are coming in, sort of changing and causing gentrification?
Yeah, so we have like a north-south street called Troost. And redlining means that for us on the never each west side of Troost, it's primarily white, housing values crazy. And on the east side, really depreciated values and primarily Black folks. And so we have a couple organizations here that have like done tax incentives and other programs that market this as a great area for urban farmers. And of course, like to be able to like buy a house and buy land, you have to meet all these credit reporting requirements that of course like privilege a white upper class person. And so less able for folks who actually live on the east side to take advantage of it. So it's being like marketed that on the east side, you can come here, you can make a lot of money because the houses are really cheap. Because the land is really cheap, and this is something that a lot of white folks are taking advantage of. And it pushing out folks of color like further east as the housing values rise. Whereas like I think if we combined movements and talked about like housing affordability and like things like that alongside this, that would be incredible because then we can talk about how to bring food back into these areas while not displacing folks.
Yeah, would you say a lot of the like the urban farmers, what's like the demographic of urban farmers in Kansas?
So in my work, I talked with white urban farmers, but there are a lot of Black urban farmers now. I mean, there were in the past, but now there's a rising movement as well. So there's a lot of young Black folks who are growing food, and I think like trying to make sure people know that they're a part of this movement as well. I don't know if you know, like she's not local, but Leah Penniman at Soulfire Farm, like I think she's in upstate New York, or maybe I'm wrong. She has a really great directory of like Black-owned farms. A lot of them are in the Kansas City area. But the folks that you see that, it's the same problem as with anything. The folks that scale up and like get the most visibility are the people who have like, the Williams-Sonoma style chicken coop aesthetic. Like it's like really fancy and it's like marketable in a way that like people want to say, oh, this is our city. So that's some of the problem I see.
And another thing about that marketable comment you said, there is this idea of like the white farm imaginary, where it's a very marketable way to describe the benefits that could come from getting your hands in the soil, getting rough in the dirt, and just, becoming active in your community, because it's considered to be a thing that where it's very noble almost to contribute to your community in a quote unquote larger sense by participating in a garden and having a very deep relationship with the soil. And BIPOC communities have a very complex relationship with the soil that you touched a bit on your research. And by extension, this will translate into a very nuanced relationship and view of gardening and agriculture and et cetera, et cetera. So can you share a bit more on how just that relationship is and how BIPOC communities will be different from their white counterparts in this way?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like for me in particular, I think about like My family is an agricultural caste, and it's not like a sexy thing for Indians to be farming. That does not have any status in India, and in most circles in the US. People are not like, oh my gosh, wow, you do that. And so for me, like I loved like gardening and like doing those things growing up, but I also knew that that was not something I could go brag about, or I knew that was not something that would make me cool. Which was a weird relationship. And for a lot of Black folks, I mean, we have to think about the fact that like slavery and like forced farm work was maybe just two generations or less away for some people. And so like in that context, to hear people say, get your hands back in the soil, it's just like wildly wrong. And that can also be the case for like refugee populations who are coming in the States from like some Southeast Asian countries. Like there are a lot of people who have these really deeply painful relationships with land. And I think that that is not talked about enough. And I think white folks often don't have that history or understanding.
Yeah, and sometimes possibly from a white lens, it seems like they will view BIPOC farmers as poor or migrants or through a stereotypically racist lens. It's not a favorable descriptions of farmers for any farmer. How do these BIPOC farmers get out there, and how do they advertise their farms, and how do they end up marketing themselves to their communities, and how do they get involved?
Well, I want to share first what someone told me when I was doing research, and I thought he put it really well. He was talking about like the fact that, you know, when you go to a farmer's market, or like imagine like when a upper middle class, like white or like white culture person goes to a farmer's market, they're like, oh my gosh, tell me about this. Like, tell me about your family history. Tell me about like where you learned to do, like they want to know the whole story, right? They don't just want the product. And so he's like, now picture me. He's like, they don't value my blackness. They don't value my family history. They don't want to feel uncomfortable about the history that I would share with them. And so they are less likely to buy my thing because they're like, whoa, if I buy that, I'm gonna have to engage in understanding like mutual oppression. I'm gonna have to think about like guilt. I'm gonna have to do all of this. I just want to buy a thing and feel wholesome. And so I think about that a lot. I thought he put it really well, thinking specifically about being a Black farmer. And he shared that pre-2020. And so sometimes I wonder, like, what is it like now for folks? It might also be more painful because there's like a fad of buy Black or buy Latinx or buy these things. And I hope that sustains. But, you know, like, I think maybe there was a shift and like, oh, let's find folks who are providing goods that we want from groups we wouldn't normally support. But I know that that can be like a fraught relationship. But for people who do want to support farmers of color, like again, I think Leah Penniman's site where she has that map is really useful. And then also like I know in Kansas City we have BUGS. It's called Black Urban Growers, and I'm sure in other cities there's like other organizations where you can find out like who actually is doing that work.
Yeah, and on the subject matter of other organizations, to look more into the issues with food charity organizations and their programs, in contrary to the organization you just mentioned, oftentimes the way that people will feel or have their guilt manifest is that they will resort to being colorblind in their language, in their approaches to unpacking these issues and attempting to solve these issues. So, can you share a bit more about how being colorblind as a food charity or food aid organization can be very detrimental?
Yeah, I think often when we're colorblind, we're centering what we know best, and so, or what we're closest to. And when white folks who run organizations are colorblind, they're centering whiteness because they don't know the experiences of others. Whereas I think theory is called targeted universalism, which is like the idea like if you're thinking about how to support the most multiply marginalized person, if you support them, then everybody else will also be supported. And that's predicated on the idea that, you know, like your race, your ethnicity, these backgrounds, they really matter, and ignoring them means that you're not creating programming that helps people.
In terms of the diction being used, terms can be very significant in the connotations they possess. such as food desert in contrast with food apartheid. And I was going to ask a bit about that, but Isabel, would you like to share your thought or?
I was going to mention how when we were doing research for this episode, these two terms came up, and I had never heard of food apartheid. And so, adding on to Naina, could you talk a little bit about like the difference between food desert versus food apartheid and your thoughts on this kind of shift in language?
Yeah, for sure. So the first thing that comes up to me is like that a desert is a naturally occurring thing. It's like, oh no, we didn't create that. It's just a desert. Whereas like food apartheid makes it really clear that like, oh, the government created this space where resources are not available. And so just that one shift is like places the blame on the right person. And then it's also, I mean, calling a place a desert is really painful to the people who like make lives in a space. And like, okay, maybe there's not access to like local grocery stores, but people still like are living happy, healthy lives or and have communities there. And so that helps calling it a food desert leads people to think that, you know, it isn't a thriving place. And then it also just like one thing I learned talking with folks, really food insecure folks, they actually didn't want like a small corner grocery store. They were like, no, I just want to carpool with a bunch of my friends and go to Walmart because they have everything. I don't want to go to a million places. I want it the cheapest. And I just want to get it all at once. And so, like, a lot of times when we call a place like a food desert, people are like, let's bring in a community garden. Let's bring in this. And I'm like, you're not actually listening to what people want. Maybe they want better bus transit, you know, access. Maybe. They want, maybe they more salient would be like thinking of it as like a job desert or like a childcare desert. Like, what are the other things that are missing and why are they not there? And so, language is really important. And like, I think making sure people place the blame in the right spot and think about the right solutions.
Yeah, and in terms of the right solutions, we touched on this a bit earlier, how these education programs will center Western nutritionism, and it gave the idea or the fact about Black communities often having higher rates of lactose intolerance, for example. So there's a start, well, there are quite a few differences between Western and non-Western diets. And people that don't adhere to a Western diet, they're often considered to be inferior or even left without sufficient or proper nutritional information. So could you share a bit more about how we can sort of decenter from this notion that Western nutrition is the thing to end all things, the one supreme sort of nutritionism that we must subscribe to.
Yeah, I'll first say that like it was really interesting to me. I cook a lot and I cook both like I don't, white food, I don't know, like Midwestern food and like Indian food because of my family. And so like I'm a really avid cook and then taking part in those nutrition classes, I was like I have never cooked any of these things nor would I ever. Like they would just not fit into my diet. I don't think they sound good. Like there is no joy in this. And if that is how like somebody who cooks a lot feels when they encounter this white Western nutritionism, then like you're not gonna get anywhere, like regardless of what your goal is. So like for me, like why are we not talking about more chapatis and vegetables and like taking salt out of that or whatever? If you want to reduce my hypertension, stop telling me to cook something completely different. Because most of the world eats like rice and chapati and like vegetables in some way or form. And they're just completely excluded from this discourse. I think something else is like what you said about soul food is like people talk about how much joy they get from like culturally specific food, and that is also not incorporated in nutritionism. I read this study once that I kind of like blew my mind that looked at people who ate like they made a meal, they plated up a meal and had people eat that, and then they tested their nutrient absorption. And then they made a meal, put it in a blender, made people drink that gross, like smoothie. And they tested
Yikes.
their nutrient absorption. And the people who had enjoyed their food absorbed more of the nutrients. And I'm like, what the fuck? That is crazy. Because that shouldn't be like you
That's
wouldn't
so
think that's
crazy.
right?
It's the
Yeah.
same thing.
The same thing. And it's like, that's because food, like we are not just like robots. Like we should be enjoying like food and community. And like you can't
I
just
love
be
that you
like
pointed out that there's a scientific explanation for like the loving and the healingness of food. It's actually quite poetic if you think about it, honestly.
yeah, man. It's beautiful. Like our bodies are beautiful, and it's just like don't just pop a vitamin. Like think about like what brings you joy. Yeah. So I.
As a vessel for fat phobia or shaming bodies, definitely.
Yeah. I think a lot of Western nutritionism is also about like how to be as small as possible, and which is just sad and sick and like and not about how to be strong. And that is like a disservice to folks they serve as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like when I've been in Asian spaces, for example, like moving to Singapore, there's such a huge celebration of food here, and it's so diverse as well. This necessarily isn't really about the fat phobia context we're discussing, but just to illustrate the celebration of food here, like this also comes from a place of privilege, but not only at the school I attend, which is a private school, even at like the local schools here, there's a diverse options of food, which I was very surprised because even from an American private school, in contrast to a local government school, my American private school had quite unhealthy, unsanitary conditions. Like there was a caterpillar found in our lettuce once. I thought I told you this story before, but I guess not. But yeah, that was not ideal to say the least. Whereas at the local school, we'll have like a range of noodle dishes, a range of other Asian foods, as well as a Western stall, and like it's so much more diverse and more celebratory. And even the way that you will enter or sit down at an Asian table, this is quite the case for like most POC families and their relatives, where they're like almost forcing you like to eat more to fill up the plate more, and you have these like amalgamation of dishes, and it's such a diverse array. Whereas I feel like there's almost a sense of like minimalism or trying to be very clean and very like kept with Western diets. So like except on Thanksgiving, because that's when people splurge. But even then, the culture on Thanksgiving is like, okay, I'm not gonna eat anything prior to our actual meal. I'm gonna like ignore. I actually don't know Thanksgiving traditions that well, but I know there's like a run people do. I don't know it. Because in
Turkey
America,
trot. if you want to enjoy food, you have to run a 10K previously and then hate yourself afterwards. So that's like the Thanksgiving tradition.
Exactly. Yeah, so I really love that you shared that research. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that was yeah. But just to sort of close on this topic, keeping in mind these very nuanced needs that are being unaddressed, being ignored, and sort of are having a band-aid being slapped on them, like a quick, easy fix by alarmingly a number of food organizations. How can a food system actively keep the needs of BIPOC individuals in mind? And what changes, you've sort of touched on this, but what changes should we look for in order to enact in diverse American cities such as Kansas City?
I don't think I have a great answer for this, but I do think like if more often people in positions of power thought about like, oh my gosh, who isn't in the room, and like really systematically worked through that, I think we'd be better off. If people went into their work with an understanding that they of course do not know it all, with a real growth mindset, that would be great. And like I try to do that in my work too. I'm like, yeah, I can speak as a biracial Indian person, but I probably mess up all the time when I'm thinking about how to support Black communities, Latinx communities, other Asian communities. And like that's part of it. I will mess up and I just need to learn and like learn how to bring folks in. And so I just really think that some relational work like that with people in the food movement, like that would be the most helpful thing. Like to learn how we're all growing in this space and, you know, we'll get better at it.
Yeah, and I think was kind of thinking about, okay, there's so many different parts of intersectionality, and I want to be able to make like quote the quote unquote best choice possible. So what should I keep in mind when I make that choice?
Ooh, okay. Good question. I think again, like I said, like in any question or decision I'm making, like centering the most marginalized person. And like, sure, that can get exhausting, but like, if you're thinking about what strawberries do I buy? Who was the least marginalized in making this thing? Or like, where do I shop for food? Like, who can I support here and there? But always thinking through that, I think, is really important. And then when I was thinking about food literacy, I was thinking about like, I think often I hear it like, oh, like knowing what is like the healthiest thing to pick or whatever. And in thinking about it like that, I I try to always remind folks or say that like when people make more money, they make better food choices. And so like always centering that back for folks in discussions when they talk about like if you're talking with like a white vegan nutritionist person, just being like, well, actually, like wage theft has a lot to do with this. Let's think about like how we could bring in like an anti-capitalist lens into this discussion because when people do better, they feel better, they eat better.
Yeah, and also when they're equipped with the better resources, they're able to make better decisions. Like there have actually been studies where the more economically viable decisions come from those like who are more equipped or who are more privileged with the money that they have. For example, one of my classes, we were debunking, I think both of you guys may be familiar with the marshmallow test where you place a marshmallow in front of a kid and you see if they can withhold themselves, like sort of restrain from eating this marshmallow initially. And the trick is that they get a reward where they'll be given another marshmallow if they're able to wait and restrain. And later on, the study was originally done, I believe, in the 1970s and redone in the 1990s. And what they found in the 1990 study was that it's not really an indicator of how disciplined you are or how much your ego depletion is strong in comparison to others. It's more an indicator of your welfare, more specifically your socioeconomic status, and where if you are someone who is from an impoverished community, if you're someone living in poverty, you're going to be ingrained and sort of like programmed, quote unquote, with this anxiety where if I have this opportunity in front of me to seize, if I have this food that I can grab, if I have another experience I could take, I'm going to take it. I don't know when the next experience will be. So often, like if you are struggling to make ends meet, if you are the kind of family that needs to rely on food stamps, for example, you're not going to be thinking of, oh, this white-based program told me to go to this farmer's market instead of this place. I'm just going to, venture all the way over there, waste money on fuel just so I can take their like irrelevant suggestions. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And just to sort of take a close, this is kind of similar to what Isabel was saying, but how can we take our own steps in our lives to support BIPOC agriculture, specifically in the US as well as on a global scale?
Yeah, so a couple things I think about. One is like maybe remain aware of like, USDA has ongoing like fights against Black farmers. They like won't pay out on settlements that Black farmers are owned. So like remain aware of these things, these injustices that are like continuing to happen against, farmers of color and farm workers of color. And be that kind of person who reminds people that that's happening. I think that can be really important. Finding local farmers of color or farmers with other systemically marginalized identities to support so that we can center a different kind of farmer when we're thinking about like what growing food looks like in the US. And like I am a big proponent of just reshaping the narrative when you have an opportunity, because I think some of the big problem about this is that like people are like, oh, I don't need to get into politics when I discuss food or like agriculture. It's just like something I can throw out there at anybody and I don't have to like argue with my uncle or whatever. But I think it's a great opportunity to argue with your uncle and to like remember that like food is really political and like here's all the, oh, like I know this study or this intersects with this and like just making sure that people have the right information, I think, can counter that narrative and ultimately, hopefully, support more diversity in the movement.
Yeah. Well, that concludes our episode on white veganism and vegetarianism. Thank you so much, Chaya, for being here. And we really hope that our audience will take a step to improve their knowledge and, constantly seek to change the narrative of BIPOC agriculture in their daily lives. So thank you so much. Today we are here with Colin and Kumiko of Jambican Studio Gardens. Colin and Kumiko, would you please introduce yourself with your name and share your current projects and plans for the future?
Hey, thank you very much. I'll go first, I guess. It's Colin Samuels speaking. Right now, I'm in my 50s. I'm farming here in Ottawa, Ontario. It's Algonquin territory. And what we do here is we grow vegetables and some flowers, and we experiment with a whole bunch of different things. We have a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, whereby people sign up to receive a box of vegetables every week or every 2 weeks from July until the end of November. And then sometimes we go into winter too. Not sometimes, we've done it for about the past 3 years. My parents are from Jamaica. My grandparents are from Jamaica and Barbados. My parents came up here to Canada in 1961, I believe, when my mother came up. And so I was born here. I have a brother and a sister. That's it for me, I think.
My name is Kumiko Watanabe. I was born and grew up in the countryside in Chiba Prefecture in Japan. My family has been growing vegetables and flowers, so we would always have fresh food and beautiful surroundings. My previous employment has mostly been agricultural in nature. When I was in middle of 20s, I moved to the Nagano Prefecture and worked at a small nursery while growing vegetables myself. During this time, I met a woman. I learned from her how to make Japanese traditional foods such as miso, umeboshi, dried daikon, and more. After a few years later, I traveled to New Zealand as a woofer and became involved in agriculture, specific living. So then I traveled to Canada, visited my husband's farm. Then I'm here living in the farm. So now I'd like to create produce from our garden and make more wonderful stuff.
Thank you so much. And if you could talk about how you started your garden, your farm, that would be amazing.
So I grew up here on this farm, although my father worked in the city. He was a government employee, a scientist, inorganic. He did inorganic chemistry. But farming and farm life was his first love. He went to agricultural school in Jamaica, and even up here in Canada, he went to school at McDonald College for agriculture, which is together with McGill University. So when he had the means, he bought this farm. It's an old dairy farm here outside of Ottawa, and we just had a big garden. All my childhood, we had a very big garden, lots of work, growing lots of things. As a side note, we also had a West Indian food store. So even though born here in Canada, I was very well versed in the food culture of the Caribbean, mostly because of the food store and because of what we grow here on the farm. After I finished university, I was going to do administrative and commercial studies, like business. I traveled for a little bit, and I began to see and understand the value of farming. And I decided to take it on in a bigger way than we had done before, because my father was so busy in town, the garden was just around the house, and the fields we sort of rented out to the neighbors. But now I've taken over the fields, and we plant in the fields, and that has allowed us to grow more stuff and supply things to more people. At some point, I remember while I was traveling and thinking about what I was going to do in the future in my life, you go back on what you know, right? You go back on what is in you. And what was in me was music. I had done piano lessons in music, and the other thing that was in me was the ability and the desire to grow vegetables mostly. So I went and I took those as things to carry me through into the future, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's so interesting about your passion for music as well, and how you're able to carry that into the future alongside farming. And you mentioned how you've been able to meet various new people, you've been able to grow new crops recently. So I'm curious to know, how has the Jamaican Studio Farms, how has this experience of farming, growing this farm, and growing all these various crops. How has that made you more connected to the people around you or in the various communities around you?
Interesting question. I love music, and I was playing music. I was involved in playing in bands and dance classes and all that stuff. But sometimes the music and the music industry and arts, it can be a little, I want to say culturally insensitive, but that it's not exactly what I mean. But it's not necessarily always a cultural safe space. And that was difficult for me. And I found at some point I needed to leave it behind. And I thought food and growing of food and gardening is a much safer place, because then you can just sort of talk about food. I found food and gardening to be safer space than as a performing musician. And so then, that has allowed me to meet a lot of people in a more comfortable setting, in more comfortable space for me.
Mostly Japanese living in Ottawa, who met through our vegetables. Some of people who met my daughter's language school, Japanese embassy, and another community event.
And what's that's how you've come to meet more people, more Japanese people?
Yeah, but we also have... she is the customer.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, she's the customer from market 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, and some people are from different places, but some we don't know where.
So the Japanese people who are part of our CSA, where do they come from to get to join our CSA? How did you meet some of them, let's say?
Some are kind of one person. Told as a part, yeah.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth, yeah. Mm. That's mostly, yeah, I think so. Because we grow like Japanese vegetables like daikon or gogo, also edamame or something. So it's difficult to buy fresh Japanese vegetable in Ottawa. So yeah, some people really interested in Pacific Japanese vegetable, yeah.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing more about the communities that you've interacted with or how you've gotten opportunities to interact with more people. I think I understood sort of what you were getting at, Colin, with how I feel like at least my understanding of what the performing arts or I guess music industry is like, it's very, I mean, in the essence, performative. I feel like with there's no other showy stuff you need to add to growing things or cultivating things. It is what it is, and you share what you know and what you love. So I think I understand what you're trying to say. And Kumiko, you were also sharing about how the Japanese community you've met through CSA. So I think we can get a bit more into the process of fermentation. And we would love to hear your knowledge about what fermentation as what it means to ferment things. Just how would you explain fermentation to people who aren't really sure what it is, or they may not even know that what they're eating is fermented food?
Fermentation is a method of preserving food.
What kind of food do you ferment?
I ferment soybeans to make miso, mostly miso. Also, I use vegetables like cabbage. Cabbage makes sauerkraut. Whenever we have vegetables, I make fermented food, because also it's good for preserving. And you can eat anytime. Yes, so actually I still have some sauerkraut from last year. So it is good to keep long time.
Soybeans though.
Soybeans, yeah.
Can't soybeans keep for a long time?
Soybeans can keep a long time, yeah. If you make miso, can keep a few years. Yeah.
Mm. But dry soybeans.
Dry soybeans, yeah. You
can keep for a long time.
Yeah, we have still 2 years ago, 3 years, yeah.
So why should we ferment soybeans?
Yeah, so we have been using soybeans, which we fermented them as miso. Fermented soybeans are believed to have better digestion. Of course, we eat tofu and like kinako, which are made from soybeans, but fermented. Yes. Okay, so natto is a popular daily food appears in every household in Japan. So as miso soup, natto is popular, popular daily food.
Daily
food appears in every household.
Mm.
Yeah, but I make miso, use our soybeans. I don't make natto. Yeah.
But the miso that you opened last time was not 1 year miso.
Last time was 3 years. I left 3 years. Yes, it was really nice, rich, and really dark color, and probably good for more digestion.
So the older miso you said has a darker color than the younger miso.
Yeah.
Hmm. What's the longest you've heard of people leaving miso?
Three is enough, I thought, but probably some people leave more longer. Yeah, but I found our customer, some people like younger miso, some people like older miso. That's it's different. People like different taste. But I found I prefer around 1.5 to 2 years. Taste good, I thought. Yeah.
And is miso only made with soybean, or can you use something else?
Like different beans?
Or different ingredients? Like can you change what goes into miso?
I'm not sure. Usually just same ingredients. I use yellow soybeans or black soybeans. Yeah, that I tried. Also, I use potato instead of soybeans. That was... Sweet meat, I make sweeter more. Yeah, and we like that.
But macrobiotics doesn't like potatoes so much, right?
But probably after fermented, gonna be better, I think. Do you use miso?
I don't consume a lot of miso. I think my mom on occasion will make miso soup. But I think the fermented food that I eat the most would probably be kimchi or pickled radishes and carrots and stuff like that. Because we just always have it with anything we're eating. If we're having rice, noodles, whatever it is, we'll have some like fermented vegetable on the side as well. So yeah, that's what we have at home. And I've always wanted to make kimchi on my own, but it seems I don't want to like get it wrong and have it like be a whole ordeal, and then I'm scared of doing it wrong basically, and not for it not to taste good. So if you have any good recipes, definitely DM me, because I want to know how to make good kimchi.
We have friends or customers who make water kimchi. They call it water kimchi. And we have other friends and customers who make like a vegan or a vegetarian kimchi without like the fish sauce or oyster sauce, whichever it is.
But water kimchi is usually not gonna use lots of hot pepper, so it's more milder. I like water kimchi because I don't like much spicy. Yeah. Mm. My husband really likes spicy stuff. But
I'm not so fond of the fish sauce in kimchi.
Yeah, I'm Vietnamese, so in a lot of the dishes my mom makes, like there's so much fish sauce, and there's always like you can dip stuff in like a bowl of fish sauce with chili peppers and stuff. So I'm basically like 50% water, 50% fish sauce. So
I thought fermented. Yeah, but I don't know process, but I thought fermented.
Yeah, I think I'm not so sure either, but I do remember hearing there's a big process to making the fish sauce.
Mm.
So yeah, I think it is a degree of fermentation involved there.
Yeah.
I'll have to dive into that more. But I think we're now going to pivot to like the second part, the bento part.
Yeah. So actually, in terms of like what I have more in my diet, I have had the bento boxes here. In terms of like food access in Singapore, mostly like if you're able to like walk a few kilometers, you will most likely run into like a hawker center or like a mini food court. Or if you go more into like the city parts of Singapore, you will find food courts where they're usually Japanese bento box stalls. So they're quite popular here, I feel like. And I want to ask you, what is bento and what is the role that bento plays in Japanese cuisine?
So bento is takeout from of everyday family meal, bring them as a lunch to school, office or picnic. Also, bento shop is also popular for those of who didn't have time to prepare them. I make bento for my daughter weekday. So sometimes I use bento box. Sometimes I separate, like sandwiches I use beeswax wrap. Do you know beeswax wrap?
Yeah. A lot of my friends had it when I grew up, and they would have like sandwiches and beeswax wrap. But I bet your food probably tastes better than their sandwiches. So,
anyway, it's popular. It's nice to just use that, and I can wash and use many times.
Mm-hmm. So, you were reading a bit more on what on like the history of bento boxes and how they've been traditionally used in Japan specifically. And we read from one article how in the bento box, there are five components. So each of the five components should represent a different flavor. This article said there should be a salty component, something sweet, sour, bitter, or umami, savory. So that's how we read that the Japanese culture uses the bento and how like bento is adopted into their culture and the role that it plays in Japanese culture. We wanted to ask, how do you feel about other people or other cultures adopting the word bento into their local cuisine and their own lifestyle?
Now that you're saying it, I've heard it before, but so you said salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and savory.
Yeah.
So that's shio,
salty,
sweet, sour is a spice. Bitter,
nigai,
and savory. What's savory?
The article said it was umami.
Umami, oh, okay.
Yeah, that was just some information that we learned about how bento plays a role in Japanese culture. But we wanted to ask you, how do you feel about other people from other cultures adopting the word bento into their own local cuisines or just putting their own unique spin to it?
It's perfectly fine to have local variation in other parts of the world. It's great to see an idea across the ocean and widely used.
Give me an example. Give us an example of like, one bento box you made.
I made for my daughter.
Yeah, just think of one example.
Yeah, one use bento box.
Any, just what goes inside?
Rice, and on top. Nori, you know, anori, yeah, and shoyu, soya sauce, but soya sauce, and sometimes egg. I cook the egg, and some like vegetable bowl means whenever we have veggie, I cook and mix with like millet or flour and make bowl and fried. Yeah, that my daughter likes. And something green, when we have green, I put green because nice looks nice. That's one bento box. Then maybe I use small container. I cut apple or some fruits. Then if not enough, I put small snack bar or something for her.
Yeah.
Something that comes to mind is I think I saw all these bento boxes, but I didn't know that they were called bento boxes. So is it weird to see bento being used in a non-traditional way where the foods inside of it aren't considered like Japanese foods?
Are you comfortable to hear somebody say bento box?
That's funny, kind of. bento box, yeah. Then, but bento box is quite funny for me to hear.
Since we're on the topic of other cultures, I guess, saying, you know, bento box and how that might be strange, this is a bit more of a topic shift away from bento or away from fermentation, but more against Japanese agriculture is treated. So my first question is, in your opinion, why do you think there's a stigma or, I guess, a discomfort from other people against Japanese or ethnic crops in the agriculture industry?
The agriculture industry. One of our neighbors here, he does corn and soy, but his main business is kind of construction. But he grew up on a dairy farm. It's so he continues the same corn, soy, and hay, although he sold the cows a long time ago. Definitely conventional, not organic at all. And but he's my neighbor. We grew up together. So he came over, must be 2 or 3 years ago, just asking about what we were doing, something or the other. And then he said, you know, yeah, I know what you're doing is the right thing. You know, it's the good thing. It's the right thing. But, you know, it's just I just can't make it work. The system doesn't allow for it. Right. So the whole system is based on you have a schedule to plant. You have a schedule to fertilize. You have a schedule to spray. The tractors are a certain size and they have to fit the field. You can't have trees in the field kind of interrupting the where the tractor's got to go. Then once you harvest everything, it's basically already sold to a market, whether it be government market or government controlled or something. You've got assistance every step along the way from that aspect of the agricultural industry. Ethnic food isn't going to make it simply because they've made the market to work for corn, soy, maybe depending on which part of the country you are, lentils, sunflower. It's all about fulfilling industrial needs. Yeah, I'm not trying to fit in anywhere at all in no way, shape, or form. And also for me too, my identity, it's complicated, you could say, because I'm born here and there is no language I know other than English, right? I mean, I speak a little bit of French, but language is not for people in their diaspora, right? Like, sometimes language is one of those things that connect you to your parents' birthplace, right? Language is a big thing to do that. It'll connect you to your parents' birthplace. But for those of us like speaking English, language is not so much of a connection or even a differentiating factor. Food and music is probably the other elements of connection.
Yeah, I feel uncomfortable, like with sometimes just can't speak well. Sometimes I can't tell. That's my uncomfortable in here in Canada. That's true. But I'm living here. That's no problem. But also many Japanese people I know I can speak Japanese, lots of connection around me. Some of our customers, so some of our friends are from my daughter's language school. Yeah, that makes comfortable, but yeah.
I'm curious to know, Colin, you mentioned that because you only know English and there's no language way to feel connected to your parents' birthplace, then mainly the medium where you feel connected is through food or through music. Kumiko, as someone who knows Japanese and can connect easily through Japanese, I'm wondering how, like, in terms of like language versus food or music, if that's important to you, or mainly food, I'm wondering how those compare.
I think language is important, but still more important is like food or like same feeling, or we got married because when I first I came this farm more than 10 years ago, I felt my husband was working just alone. I felt kind of strange, but same time, I felt really comfortable in this environment land. So even I couldn't talk much with him. I just feel something that was really important for me.
The first day that she came, I think I was harvesting beans. Or you came and you harvested beans. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I can't remember which beans it was. Also, your grandfather grew beans, right?
Yes, my grandfather.
Adzuki beans, lots of adzuki beans. Adzuki, I should say, not adzuki beans.
Beans and some. Anyways, more important is
feeling.
Feeling is really important. Yeah. My husband is the first time I saw him, his style, he's just, he didn't use any fertilizer, just kind of tilling and make bed and plant. That was really new for me. Yeah, I never had that before. Never seen before.
How do you guys integrate or balance either Jamaican or Japanese food or methods? Or do you guys lean towards one side more than the other? How do you sort of bring those two together?
I think of my Aunt Ag. It's my grandmother's cousin, older cousin, Aunt Ag, in Jamaica, in Hanover, in the hills, the hills of Hanover. And up to 94 years of age, last time I saw her, which is about 10 or 15 years ago or more. So she's passed on, obviously. But she would walk. So that was the land she grew up on. She kind of knows every inch of it. She knows where the trees are, what's going on. And she can walk every piece of it. In Japanese, what's the term? Hyakusho, right?
Hyakusho
is like, you could say peasant farmer, but it's like a farmer who basically does everything. Hyakusho is like 100, right?
Yeah.
So can do 100 things. So that's my Aunt Ag, my grandmother's cousin. I think of that. So then when I went to Japan and I'm seeing different farms and the equipment that people use and what they do and just the general approach, it's not foreign. I can see and understand what's happening. Essentially, I see that they're not so different, right? The approaches are not so different. And then it's just to match. I mean, Kumiko mentioned the thing about the coconut.
Oh, yes.
The coconut and the miso. But you know, coconut smells like the sea. It in a lot of ways it smells like the sea. So it really is it's foreign to a certain degree, but also it's familiar once you
mm-hmm.
essentially once you mix it up, it kind of becomes becomes familiar, yeah. Even though
because of sea, we eat lots of sea products.
So I'm thinking really that when you just take things and just sort of strip away all the extra stuff and all the externalities, we there's a lot of similarities.
Oh.
A lot of connection points, kind of just underneath the surface, but you kind of have to strip away all that surface stuff in order to get to the what's underneath, you know.
And like when you talk about that combination of cultures and combining both of your passions for growing and farming, where do you see your daughter participating in this cross-cultural connection? Do you see like the food that you provide to your daughter? Like, what is that impact of the food you provide to your daughter, and how does that create her sense of identity?
I want her to feel like whatever she's doing or whatever she's getting is normal, just normal. It's just normal. Even if nobody else is doing it, it's still normal. Yeah. If you put two ingredients together and they taste good, then that should be normal. There's nothing wrong with that. If they go well together to your taste, then that's fine. She made a song yesterday. She made a song because she's learning music in school. There was one song that she was learning. So she took that song and mixed it with part of which one was it? Not Ziggy Marley, Stephen Marley? Anyways, one of Bob Marley's sons had a song, and I forget which one, Stephen, I think it was, had a song about Ethiopia and Africa. So we watched that video a few times on YouTube, and we enjoyed it. It was like a sea shanty, that song that she learned in school. And she took some of the melodies of that and mixed it with some of the melody from this Stephen Marley song with her own lyrics, and then just created a new song. Pretty interesting. She's good. She's all good. She's, you know what I mean? She's all good, really.
Sounds like the love for music is passed down.
I think so. I think so.
Yeah. It's great to hear, of course, when like children are unafraid to mix and match and do the non-conventional, non-traditional things. It's always a really good thing to see and hear, especially when you hear so many other people's stories, especially from immigrant families. They're the first generation children or second generation children who go to school, maybe more like schools with more Western communities, and they bring their ethnic lunches, and they have, even as children from other kids, they get unkind remarks or judgment that isn't necessarily coming from a place to be like evil, rude, or mean, but just it's unfamiliar, and they don't really know how to interact with that or deal with something unfamiliar. So I guess, how would you, in a broader sense as parents, you have a child, you would know how other children in a sense would broadly, vaguely be like in a way. How would you encourage children in general to be proud of the food they eat? Or what would go through your mind, or like what comes to you when you think about trying to encourage them to be okay and comfortable with their own unique things that they bring to the table?
As you said before, Okasan makes this with, Okasan's love is in here, right?
Oh, yeah.
Kasson's love is in here. So morning time is something else in this house, right? Because it's big lunch preparation and hair combing and so on and so forth, but big bento preparation, right? So it takes a lot of time and energy. So the idea is that in this case, be proud of your lunch, enjoy your lunch, because there's lots of love that's gone into the preparation of it, right?
Yeah,
to know that your lunch doesn't come from nowhere, right?
Yeah, I think that goes into the next section on passion for growing and how there is a lot of difficulties with farming, growing food. You have to put the effort in, you have to put the hours in to really get something and get the final product and create something really out of, like, you have a seed, you have to cultivate that into a bigger thing, into a thing that you can eventually cook into a larger meal. It's a process. It requires time and care and love for the experience, and it's a rewarding experience. So what would you guys say that you love most about growing and farming?
Because you've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, I've been growing for 15 years. Growing is part of my life. I like to create. Growing is not only for eating, so I can always find something new, lots of discoverings.
Every day is different. If I go for a walk every day, every morning, every day is different. Also, I like to eat what I grow, the relationship with the land and with the plants and the trees and all that, it's very different from dealing with people. Dealing with land and plants is, I don't want to say healing either, although it works. It's, I could say peaceful, it's content. Anyways, all these different words just kind of means the same thing. It's a safe space, even though, you know, it may not be perfect, whatever. Maybe there's lots of water. Maybe it's too hot. Sun is shining, something or the other. But still, it's always adaptable, plants and land. It's forever changing. And so it's an accepting and peaceful place. People aren't necessarily like that all the time, although I do like people and enjoy people. But land and plants, to me, is much more comfortable.
Yeah.
So that's why I kind of, that's what I love the most about it.
Do you see your daughter, like, seeing these qualities and values that farming brings to one's life?
you want to say something? So my father, you know, rest his soul, he always wanted us to go out and do stuff. One of his classic things was, you know, half an hour, all I need is half an hour, just 30 minutes, you know. And that was stressful for us children at the time. And I kind of said to myself, I don't want to do that to any child of mine. So I'm trying to instill just an appreciation and a love for the natural world outside and the gifts that come from the natural world outside. That's my main thing. But I don't want to be forcing anybody to take up farming in that sense, but I at least want people to be able to recognize the gifts and the beauty of outside, you know. And she's got it. Like she does recognize, I think, a lot of that.
Yeah.
I mean, at least when I grew up in the city, so when I went to this farm school when I was in sixth grade, like, that was the first time I really saw stars and I really explored nature. I was like 12 when I first saw like stars. It was crazy. And I really found so much peace and fulfillment in the quiet of nature and being able to connect with animals and really just not have the distractions of cars and honking horns and ambulances and all of that all around. So it must just be so empowering to grow up in a space where you can sit in your own silence and recognize like the birds chirping and you know, leaves falling and stuff like that. Because for me it was a lot of like go, 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 but in the sense that we're just trying to get from point A to point B the fastest and not really take in the surroundings. So that's so awesome for her. That concludes the interview portion of this podcast. Are there any final messages you would like to bestow upon our listeners, or where can the listeners find you guys? I know you guys have stalls and you're selling, you like you said, the CSA. So if you'd love to talk more about that and plug all of your stuff for our listeners.
Plug all of our stuff. First, anything you want to say? Did you say everything?
No, just that I want to say.
Joseph.
I want to say for many of you who is living in the city and go to the market to buy your vegetables, the biggest thing you miss is the connection with the food you take home, grow any vegetable from a seed, growing to going to a farm, walk around and feed, touch the produce, make dinner with them. It's the essence of life that we use our senses to connect with that we eat.
Yeah, I'm just going to do the plugging.
Okay.
That's okay. So It's mostly CSA that we do, which is just delivery to people. But we do, people can come to the farm, and we enjoy to have people coming to the farm. Trying to do more events this year, maybe like a monthly event or something.
Yeah.
First up is we're going to be doing a negi harvest. Negi harvest, it's long green onions. Negi, naga negi is long green onions. And so we're going to be doing a harvest of that. We like to bring people out to the farm. All that is through our website, jambican.cs.ca, which is jambican.ca. And it's the same, Jambican is on all our Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. I think that's it. And we're not really at any market. Although we did sign up for the Main Street Market here in Ottawa, but it's not every week, it's occasional. I think we did four, once a month or something like that. So, and that's mainmarketottawa.ca. I think that's it. Kimiko's Instagram.
Yeah, I have Instagram, it's different than my husband. He has Jambican, but my Instagram has, I post more than him. And you can see our daily life, also more interesting stuff. Yes. Can I say
yes.
My Instagram, Howakaa.
That's Instagram, right?
That's my Instagram. So, yeah.
I don't love Instagram so much. I find it difficult, but
I enjoy.
Actually, one point to make, though, is Kimiko actually did, I don't know, she's not going to tell you this, but she did, after high school, she did a course in photography. Kind of.
Yeah.
That's not me, so she has an eye.
We would like to come, more people, and see our farm, how we grow, and then you can feel our land energy.
Yeah, that's the most important point, actually. So anytime people sign up for like CSA and whatnot, I it's always, yes, welcome, join us. You're welcome to join. But please, you know, read our get to understand where we're coming from so that you just modify your expectations kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? We do have good produce and stuff, but we're kind of slow. You know, we like to do things kind of naturally and less stress involved. So it's we do things a little bit slow and different. So we do encourage people to kind of come out and feel the energy slow down a little bit and feel our energy.
Our customer, she likes to come here, a CSA customer, because she wants to feel energy. Also, she always say it's different. So, yeah, really hope more people come and see our farm.
Want more of Dear Asian Girl? You can find us everywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. We're on everything. Can't get enough? Subscribe, follow, rate, review to get all the updates on the latest at DAG. Let us know your feedback and what we can do to improve. We also can be found on Instagram. Follow us at Dear Asian Girl to receive updates about our latest episodes and fun facts about the host. We'd love for you to reach out. DAG, Dear Asian Girl, a podcast dedicated to share the stories of Asian girls everywhere. For the Asian girl, by the Asian girl.